Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. You're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or CPRMetro.org. Today we have a very good show, as always. We have two wonderful candidate women from the Green Party who are running for state offices here in California. Our first guest is Laura Wells. Laura Wells is a political and social activist here in California running for state controller. And right after Laura, we'll have Ellen Brown, who is an attorney and an author and a banking activist who is running for state treasurer. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Laura Wells. Laura Wells, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Well, thanks for having me. Great to talk with you.
Oh, it's always good to talk with you. And like we were saying before the recording, the struggle is always with us.
Always.
I put on my Facebook wall yesterday, it'd be nice to have, once in a while, have a downhill battle instead of a uphill battle.
Yeah.
So we can get a little bit of rest. But, you know, going uphill, I think, gives us more strength than downhill. But we deserve a rest every once in a while.
Yeah, well, it strengthens your heart.
Yeah.
So you have to, just literally, when you're running uphill, your heart needs to be strong.
Uh-huh.
So that's it.
But every once in a while, we like to put our feet up on the handlebars and coast for a minute.
Yes.
And then another frustrating thing is you've been an activist for a long time. It just seems like no matter how hard we work, it seems like the problems are just magnifying.
It does seem, you know, the one thing that I have to go to is the fact, you know, because you hear bad news, bad news, bad news, and
right.
I know that we're not alone, you know, everybody, even people who are, you know, whether people are or not, highly politically engaged. And so, but the way that I have to look at it is, in order for myself to keep going, is that you actually never do know what's going to happen. And
right.
You don't know where the break is going to be, the break toward a better life. And you could be at the point of, I mean, sometimes this happens in your personal life too, at the point of the most frustration and the most wondering what in the world is going to happen, it will shift toward the better, you know, something will open up. And so, and besides, it's own reward to live while working to create the kind of world that you want for yourselves, for the elders, you know, and for the next generation is its own reward, and the reward is a real vital life. And lots of great people that you run into.
I was about to say, and we have some great comrades and colleagues that we are able to develop relationships with. And I count you as one of those people. And that's, you know, people oftentimes tell me that, you know, Cindy, you're just muddying the waters by running for office. You know, we just need two choices. We need the Democrat and the Republican. But speaking for myself, is that I run for office to give those people a voice that don't feel like they have a voice in the, you know, in the establishment. And I think that that is a really important reason to run for office.
I would add, yes, I agree. And the other thing is that there are solutions. We know there are solutions. We know that there are ways that we can treat our environment a whole lot better. We know that there are better ways that we can have schools. We know that there are better ways that we can, that our economy can function, for example, with a state bank, publicly owned bank, where we're investing in California, not Wall Street. We know that there are solutions like this. And what we know, because we see it every 4 years, no matter whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans that are in power, no matter whether it's a state that's all Republican or a state like ours that's virtually all Democrat, you know, just to expand on that California has every single statewide officer, and both senators are Democrats, and they've had 2/3 majority in the House, in both houses of the legislature. So no matter whether it's Democrat or Republican, every 4 years you look around and things are worse in terms of very important things like education and like retirement, the economy, and things like that. What they need to be is not lobbied. They need to be replaced.
Well, absolutely.
They do not pay attention to citizen lobbyists.
Right.
They don't have to. What they have to do is satisfy them, their the people who have financed their campaigns, and the people actually that they relate to, the people whose group they want to be in. And so what they are afraid of is the fact that they do not have the numbers of people. They know that they're like the 1% of this, you know, very small percent, and that when people get together, that is when they will be in serious trouble, and they know it. And so they're perfectly happy if we, when we hold back from the electoral system, from politics, because you say, oh, it's all dirty. I mean, I'm convinced they would put it on a billboard. You know, politics is so corrupt, it's so dirty, it's so awful, they won't even count your vote. They'll put that on a billboard because it demotivates people.
Right.
You know, it makes us back off. So the question is, how do we get people not to back off, but to just plunge in? And I was just listening to KPFA about CCSF, the City College of San Francisco, and how they're fighting back, and it's been in a big struggle to keep that wonderful institution. And they've had some successes. And so that, you know, success breeds success.
Mm-hmm.
So, the more I try to look for those times where we actually have gone up against the City College of San Francisco, the corruption of the accreditation system, you know, where they go after this wonderful college and make up stuff to make it look like a failure.
Right.
Yeah, so we need to run, and there's so many people that I'm hoping do run. There's some wonderful young activists who really get it. They've been on the wrong end of this system all their lives, really, and they really get what the problem is. They get that the Democrats and the Republicans are not helping them, and that they will run for office and do what they've done in Richmond, which is run together with a group of people, stay, keep their community activist roots, stay connected to the rallies and be in the streets, and run for office and take no corporate money. That, to me, is the huge difference between you and me, you know, between Cindy Sheehan and Laura Wells and Alan Brown and all the people from especially the parties, the Green Party and Peace and Freedom parties, as well as other people. But that's the difference. That's why in Richmond, you look at the mayor of Richmond, Richmond is the biggest city in the country with a Green Party mayor.
Gail McLaughlin. I just saw her a couple weeks ago at a Cuban 5 event. It was awesome to reconnect with her.
Oh, that's great, yes. And there she is standing up against the biggest corporation in the state, which is Chevron,
right,
which has refineries in Richmond. And so if this huge corporation has refineries in Richmond, why isn't Richmond rich? You know, I grew up in Michigan. Why wasn't Detroit rich?
Absolutely.
But she's going up against her, hey, you know, you guys are doing a couple of things here. One, you're polluting. Two, you're not paying your fair share of taxes. You're not helping Richmond, and you're hurting Richmond. And she was able to stand up against it. Why? Because they started to replace the Chevron-owned politicians. And they've made a huge difference. They don't even have a majority. And so this is a great reason for people to vote for people who just, you know, make the effort and vote. There's 30 to 33% voter turnout in most primaries. June 3rd, 2014. Everybody take out your calendars and write it down. June 3rd, 2014. Your vote actually can count a lot because of the low voter turnout. So get out. You and everybody and the buddies who don't want a corporate-run government and do that. And I wanted to say one more thing about Richmond.
Uh-huh.
Not only going up against Chevron, but as a lot of folks have heard, going up against the Wall Street banks.
Right.
To keep people in their homes. What does that take? No corporate money. It takes people running for office. It takes people in positions of power in the government in order to implement the solutions that otherwise people just talk about.
And I just want to say, too, if a listener doesn't live in California, you can certainly call your friends, starting at the beginning of May, and, your friends that do live in here, tell them to vote for alternative candidates. Tell them to get their butts out to the polls on that day. Vote for alternative candidates and tell them to spread the word. I mean, that's our major difficulty, I think, is being able to break through the blockade of the corporate media. And you did that so brilliantly back in 2010 when you were running for governor. I'm not sure if you meant to do that, but you wanted to get – you had a ticket to go into the governor's debate. It was Brown versus Meg Whitman, I think. And you were the Green Party candidate. You were excluded from the debate. You had a ticket to go in, and they arrested you.
Yeah, I mean, scary me,
you're very terrified.
What do they want? They wanted to talk about he said, she said, and point the fingers at each other while they're both defending Proposition 13 from 1978 rather than say, yes, defend the good parts of that, but fix the parts. Otherwise, they wouldn't want to talk about, a real question about the taxes and the economy and how, yes, lower income and, poor people and middle class all are getting taxed. Yes, very highly. The rich, no, not. But, and a state bank, the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Did they talk about a publicly owned bank to get us out from under the horrors of the Wall Street banks who have the power, they and their alliances have the power to lower any state, this is across the country, they have the power to lower the credit rating of the state, and then what does that do? That makes you have to pay more interest, higher interest. They've done so many things that have been found, like the municipal, the credit swap, credit default swaps, and all of this stuff that has been, have been found that they have manipulated things and abused the economies across the country. So, yeah, so then I was arrested. And I'd never been arrested in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people I admire so much have been arrested. But I always, was one of those people, they said, well, if you don't want to get arrested, move over there. And I always moved over there, but this time.
Right.
the guy said, and his name was Harry, which is interesting because I've got Harrys in all the generation of, brother, father, grandfather. So Harry, the security guard that used to be a police officer in San Rafael, said, you don't belong here.
Oh.
And those were not the magic words.
Right.
I do belong here. And somebody gave me a ticket while I was there, said you should at least go in there and be in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, he said, you don't belong here. That's embarrassing. And arrested me. But metal handcuffs, back of the squad car, dipped my head, the whole thing. And then they tried to figure out what to do with me. But, they are so afraid of any of us having a voice, being at the table, electing people into those positions, that they will do anything to stop us from doing it. But the main thing I think in their arsenal, their weapons of mass distraction, is to dishearten us. To make us feel as if it doesn't make any difference, that whether we go to a rally, whether we, or whether we vote, to make us feel that's not, powerful is a way that they one by one try to undermine our collective power. And I just, you know, there's a part of me, and I think there's a part of a lot of people, who just go, okay, 1%, what is it you want me to do? You want me to sit home and not vote and sit home and not take to the streets. That's what you want me to do. I'm not going to do it. For me, for my kids, you know, for everybody's kids, all our kids, for the next generations, for the seniors who are retiring, you know, I'm not going to do what you 1%, 0.1% want me to do.
Well, and then it certainly had the opposite effect of shutting you out of the debate, that it mm-hmm. was people actually heard about you and got to go and look at your program.
Yeah, and people are like, this, I thought we lived in a democracy.
Right.
You know, it's like, yeah, a friend of mine said it was like somebody was arresting my sister or, you know, mm-hmm. my aunt or something. It's like, yeah. And all we're trying to do is, I keep using that word solutions because there are solutions. All we're trying to do is look squarely at these problems that we have and bring in the solutions. I mean, I know you, Cindy, went the way extra mile to call attention to the horrors of the military expenditures of money and of our young people, you know, like your son. And that is one solution right there that
right.
they've tried to keep us shut up about. And, you know, if people believe that rallies don't matter, then, well, it's just not true, actually. Rallies do. Rallies and voting do matter.
Well, you know, yes, we might not have stopped any wars, but we certainly have stopped many, many people from participating in them. And like you mm-hmm. said, we have to look for our victories where we can find them. So,
well, Syria, you know.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I mean, you know.
I think Putin had more of a hand in stopping that, but and I think Putin is paying for that now. And of course the U.S. hasn't ruled out that possibility ever. And that's why we can't stop, because we have to let the people in other countries know how much we care about them also.
Right. That it, our government is not, you know, that we as Americans are not of the same point of view as our
absolutely.
Government.
We have to keep on hammering that. So let's mm-hmm. talk about now your Green Party run for comptroller of the state of California.
Well, the comptroller is an interesting position because...
Did I say comptroller?
Some states and cities call it, have a P in it,
uh-huh.
and some don't, and ours doesn't.
Okay.
So it's controller.
Controller.
And, yeah. And it's like the chief bookkeeper of the state. You know, you follow the money as it comes in and follow the money as it goes out
mm-hmm.
and does audits. And it's interesting that it seems like a technical position, but it is elected by the people. And so it isn't like the controller reports to the governor or reports to the legislature. It reports to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And what the people need to know is what is going on with where does the money come from in the state and where is it going to? I know that John Chung, who's the current controller, and since he's termed out after 8 years, he's running for treasurer, and he became a hero in people's eyes because he stood up to Governor Schwarzenegger
mm-hmm.
and would not and went ahead and paid people who their salaries rather than give them IOUs, and everybody goes, wow, he's great. Okay, yeah, that was good, but that's a pretty low bar.
Right.
You know, I mean, is he telling us as the California Budget Project, and I'm so focused on California, but it's across the country. I know you have a national audience, and it's across the country where these kinds of things are happening, where the bar is set very, very low, and where our public officials in the state capitals should be telling us these basic facts. The rich used to pay taxes, and they're not paying it anymore. And so they're gathering up all of this money. What do they do with this money? Well, I'll tell you, there's only so many islands and jet fleets and parties. You know, only so many that you can do. What they do is they buy power.
Mm-hmm.
And they buy politicians, and they buy media. And so they buy the positions that are where we get our information and where decisions are made. And so what we need to know from the controller's position, the position of the bookkeeper, follow the money, and it's also the chief auditor, where I would be auditing the finances of various jurisdictions. Well, I would like to do is say, okay, the state lottery. A lot of people ask me this. What happened to the lottery? That was supposed to save education. You know, they opened up gambling, and then who's usually gambling? It's people that really can't afford it because they see it in this American dream of ours as basically their only chance, you know, of really making a lot of money is to buy a lottery ticket and win.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what happened with that? That would be one audit, but the big audit is what happened 36 years ago in Jerry Brown's first term as governor. When he was first governor, he was elected in 76,
right.
And then in 1978, because if he had taken care of business, if he had solved the terrible problem of the property taxes going so high that people could no longer afford it, it would go from $1,000 to a few years later, it would be $4,000 a year. You know, it would go up four times. And it got to where people couldn't, especially seniors on a fixed income,
right.
Their incomes weren't going up. And so they couldn't go up. They couldn't pay that kind of property tax. There are ways that could have been fixed. And Jerry Brown didn't do it. And when Prop 13 came up in desperation, the people followed Jarvis and Gann. When Proposition 13 came up to flatten the property taxes, then the people went for it. And Jerry Brown did not use the power that he had to make sure that it didn't pass, you know, to say, no, let's do something else. He's never, had he been on our side then, he would have done it. Okay, but let's say, oh, well, he was young or whatever, you know, with his first term. Let's say that he couldn't help it. He was re-elected governor.
Right.
32 years later, and
right.
He's running again, and he has not touched it. With all the power that I talked about at the beginning, all that power he had of the Democrats all over the place in Sacramento did not change it. Yes, keep property tax low enough that people can stay in their homes. There's no need to get rid of that. People love Prop 13 because of that, and we can keep that love for Prop 13, but we can fix the parts that have harmed our schools to where they're among the lowest per pupil spending in the entire country.
Oh, absolutely. So, Jerry Brown.
Jerry Brown. And everybody lines up and toes his line. We need people in there, controller, treasurer. We need a new governor. We need, you know, Cindy. But we need people in there who are not towing his line because his
Absolutely.
Line is not helping us.
I want to give you some good news, though.
Good.
There was about, I don't know, 15 of us from my campaign, and we were in front of the convention center. In Los Angeles last weekend because it was a state Democratic convention, and we were the only alternative campaign there. I wish there were more of you all with us, but you could not believe all of the Democrats' delegates to the state convention, so you would think that these people were super Democrats, that came up to us and said, we are disgusted with Jerry Brown, we're voting for you. And there was an anti-fracking protest, too. Almost all of the people at the anti-fracking protest, they were carrying signs that said another Democrat against fracking. came over to us, got flyers, told us that they were supporting our campaign, and even like John Burton denounced Brown.
Wow.
Yeah, and so there, we need to exploit that disgust with Brown, because like you said, we need to show people that just because the state has done it this way forever, we don't always have to do it this way. And I told Ellen in our interview that, you know, our job, I think, is like Hugo Chavez, to inspire the citizens to take their lives and their futures in their own hands.
Right. That we do have the power. The 1% absolutely knows it, so we should get a clue. We should know it.
Well, wouldn't it be awesome to have a government in place that works with the people, not against them? But what we're trying to say, like Chavez said, is that I can't do it by myself. We need you all to work with us on this, on these wonderful solutions that would bring peace, prosperity, and environmental sustainability to our state.
And so they set up, you know, like the countries in Latin America where they got new constitutions, including Ecuador and Bolivia, was that they set up processes where the citizens were involved in changing the laws, you know, in bringing about the new constitutions, the new national constitutions, as well as involved in their local communities and the decisions made at that level. And that's what we would bring about. Because why? Because it's a value, you know, the value of people as opposed to corporate persons and as opposed to the outrageous concentration of wealth and power. You know, with concentration of wealth comes concentration of power. And that's what we're opposed to.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Laura. And I know I always say I will never take any corporate money, but, you know, strangely enough, I haven't been offered any because...
Yeah, I know people say, well, how can I trust that? It's, trust me, they won't say, you know,
they know
trust
that
the corporations
we want to,
not to give it me.
You know, like in Richmond, they know that we want them to pay their fair share like they used to when education and the social safety net in this state were actually models and worked and aren't demolished like they are now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we you know, and the thing about turning the corner is that, as is happening in Richmond, it doesn't mean that there's no magic wand where you can correct everything right away.
Right.
But there is something very heartening about knowing that things are heading in the right direction. You know, that are heading in that direction, and step by step, as they say, paso a paso.
And Gail is terming out, and then some of these things didn't happen until well into her second term, but she had to build, you know, the trust and political support of her community. And that's what she told me. She said, Cindy, I couldn't have done any of this without my community.
No, and that's the alliance of folks, you know, and they stayed with the community activism and with the electoral politics, because as community activists, they kept running into the brick wall of City Hall, so they realized they wanted to run for office, and they never did have a majority, and yet were able to make a lot of headway. And Gail is running for city council, so she's termed out as mayor, but she's going to... But she's not backing away from Richmond. She's running for city council, and somebody, an ally, is running for mayor, Mike Parker. Eduardo Martinez is running, and he's gaining strength. You know, and he's run before, and he's gotten more votes. And so that, and there's also Jovanka Beckles is in the city council, and so they've got a, you know, they're... anybody who can help in Richmond, California, do it. And across the country, there are people who are running without corporate money. Sometimes people say, well, can they win? It's like, well, here's something to, for us that we know.
Mm-hmm.
When the people who take corporate money, who toe that line, when they win, we don't win. So why should we want them to win?
Absolutely.
Why, why even care if they can win? If they can win, what? We don't.
Right, exactly. We always lose in that situation, no matter who wins. We, the people, the 99.9%, we always lose. Well, Laura, I can't believe that we've already been talking for a half hour now. It's gone by so fast. Is there anything else you want to add? And I also want you to let my listeners know your website and where they can get more information about your campaign and sign up to help get you elected for controller.
Controller, yes. And so that is every chance you can vote and vote for people that don't take corporate money. So my website is myname.org. So it's laurawells.org. And the thing to do is put on your calendar June 3rd, 2014, vote and vote no corporate money. And create, you know, whatever, some voting parties and tell each one reach 10, you know, each person reach 10 and really say, vote. You know, here's an easy way to vote. Don't vote for anybody that takes corporate money. You know what that means? Some races, you're not going to vote. How do you know who doesn't take corporate money? There are ways to find out. We're working on a no corporate money website and campaign. But Greens never do. Peace and Freedom, you're safe. You know, they'll find out. You'll find out. If they don't take corporate money, you'll know it. If you see their face plastered all over TV, they take corporate money.
Absolutely. Well, Laura Wells, thank you so much for returning to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, and I wish you and the state of California all the best, because I know that a victory for we alternative candidates would be a victory not just for California but for the rest of the country, because that would send a big message to the empire.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. LauraWells.org. Laura Wells, we'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much again. Our next guest is Green Party candidate for State Treasurer Ellen Brown. Ellen, like I said, is an attorney, and she's an author, and she is a public banking advocate, and she was on the show before to talk about her book, The Web of Debt. Ellen Brown, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, thanks, Cindy. Great to talk to you.
Well, last time we had you on, we were talking about your book, Web of Debt, but now we have some exciting news and things to talk about for the people of the state of California, and actually could be an inspiration for 48 other states that don't have a state bank, but you are running for treasurer of the state of California with the Green Party.
That's right, and state bank is my main motive for running.
Well, it's an important issue, and like you said in your statement when you talked about running for treasurer, is that with the potential of California, we have, an amazing chance to do wonderful things for this state by going to a state bank. So can you tell my listeners why you decided to run for treasurer? And then we'll get into what a big difference a state bank would be to the state of California.
Well, I'm president of the Public Banking Institute, and what we do, up till recently, we're an all-volunteer organization. We've just now started working on actually having a staff, because it's gotten rather big. But so what we've done was to try to spread this idea that states could save themselves, like North Dakota did, by having their own state-owned banks. First of all, Wall Street, as we know, is corrupt, and we see more and more cases of fraud that they're either admitting to or settling out at sums that you simply wouldn't settle out at if you weren't actually admitting to having done it.
Right.
So do we really want to be dealing with these banks? But we think we don't have any choice because there's nothing else that's big enough. The state can't put its money in community banks for various reasons. But what we could do is what North Dakota did in 1919. They were losing the farmers were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers, just as people lost their homes in the 2008 crisis. Right now in California, I think something like, not sure of the figure, but I'm thinking 25% of mortgages are underwater, which means they're worth, the home is not worth anywhere near what the mortgage is. So they're sort of trapped in these losing investments where they're putting all their money into, to pay the mortgage when the house just isn't worth that. So we, the people, have borne the brunt of this big collapse that was the fault of Wall Street, and it was due to fraud. And there, I've written a lot about that, various mm-hmm. frauds. So in North Dakota, when they realized they were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers, they got banded together, formed the Nonpartisan League, managed to win an election, and formed their own bank. They also formed their own granary. At that time, it was a Rockefeller bank that was linked to the Rockefeller Railroad, was linked to the Rockefeller Granary. It was all a big cartel, and the granary wasn't taking their grain, although it was good grain. So they formed their own, and they still have the largest publicly owned granary in this country. And they have the only publicly owned bank. They also are the only state that escaped the credit crisis. They have the lowest foreclosure rate in the country, the lowest default rate on credit card debt, and the lowest state debt. So the model is they all of the revenues of the state are deposited by law into the Bank of North Dakota. So that's their deposit base. So virtually their entire depositor is the state. They do take a few individual deposits, but they're sort of token. They're really the place for the state to deposit its money. And then they're able to do what all banks do, which is leverage capital and deposits into credit for the state. So they're keeping their own credit at home. California currently has a debt of $90 billion, and of that, in addition to that, about $70 billion will be owed in interest by the time, or will have been paid in interest by the time the whole thing is paid off. So nearly as much is owed in interest as is owed in principal. So if we had our own bank, we could actually, in theory, refinance that entire debt for interest-free. So we could, if we'd had our own debt all along, or sorry, our own bank all along, we could theoretically have saved that entire $70 billion in interest. But more realistically, probably what they would do if they set up their own bank would be to, they could buy existing bonds, which is the safest thing to do. And then basically, right now, the treasurer, for example, manages a treasurer's investment pool of $52 billion. These are funds from all over the state that money can't be spent. I mean, it can't, the governor can't spend it, or the legislature can't spend it as part of the general fund because it's all earmarked for different things. It's like the highway fund or the education fund or this or that county.
Right.
But what they can do, the treasurer manages it, so he has it in various investments. And it's currently earning overall 0.26% interest. So it's earning almost nothing.
Right.
So let's say you took that money and you put it as deposited as CDs in your own bank and say, well, we'll pay you 0.3% or 0.4%, you know, something better than what they're making now. So we'd still be paying them almost nothing. And then what you can do is you take that deposit or that deposit base, and banks are allowed to create credit equal to their deposits, less mm-hmm. 10%. So you basically double your money in the form of credit.
Well, what is the opposition to this? What are they saying? I know that most of our politicians are firmly in the back pockets and I'm talking about Democrats and Republicans, in the back pockets of banking and banks and Wall Street, what is their overt opposition to that? What do they tell the voters?
Well, in Washington State, for example, they had a bill for a state-owned bank, and the treasurer there said, we don't have the money to lend. We can't be lending out our money because we need it for our budget, which just shows, I mean, it's hard to believe that the treasurer himself doesn't really understand how banking works.
Right.
But maybe that's true, or maybe it's a misconception about what you can do with a bank. We're not talking about spending that money. We're talking about turning it into credit at the same time that it stays on deposit in the bank. And then when you do spend it, when the government comes for the money, if the borrower and the depositor come for their money at the same time, what banks do, all banks do this, is borrow from somewhere else in order to balance their books. So they can borrow at the Fed funds rate, which is 0.25%, which means they're borrowing deposits from other banks, effectively, or borrowing reserves from other mm-hmm. banks, which are a reflection of deposits. So the government can then borrow very cheaply compared to, let's say, Greece right now. Governments can wind up paying very high interest rates, and they're subject to the bond vigilantes and interest rate swaps and all sorts of expenses and sort of threats, market threats, that if they had their own bank, they could not only save that money, or they could, in effect, be borrowing at 0.25%, the Fed funds rate, but they could escape having to do what the investors or Wall Street requires them to do with their money. We could be using it for our own purposes, issuing credit to support our own businesses.
Well, and like you pointed out in your article, is that our current state budget has been, quote unquote, balanced, but Jerry Brown's is using much of our resources and wealth to pay off debt, while one in four children in the state lives below the federal poverty line, while education is astronomical. It's being, you know, working class people are being priced out of higher education, and they're making public education from K-12, they're destroying it. And not only do one in four children in our state live below the federal poverty line, but 17% of people in California live below the federal poverty line, which is already too low anyway. So clearly, if we weren't beholden to pay off all this interest, we could solve these problems.
Right, and we had a bill 2.5 years ago for a feasibility study in a state-owned bank, and it actually passed both houses of the legislature. That's actually what motivated me to run, and then Jerry Brown didn't sign it. And he said, we've already got a banking committee. We can do this in-house. We don't need another committee. But then we never heard any more about it. So Laura Wells decided to run for controller, and and I decided to run for treasurer. So together we would apply some pressure to, you know, show them the wisdom of this, that we can actually save ourselves by being our own bankers, that it's really the financialization of the economy. It's like a parasite on the economy that's just sucking everything out. We're up to 30% financialization now, which is pretty much the tipping point for. It's like what they used to call usury, you know, it was a sin, but now they've given it a nice name, which is financialization, but it's basically money making money without making things. So if the parasite, that part of the economy that's living off of other people's productivity, gets bigger than the productivity is able to support, that's when the economy collapses, and we're very close to that.
Well, it is austerity, as you pointed out, and you talked about Greece. You know, I've been to these places working with activists in Greece, Ireland. You know, they had a terrible banking, I shouldn't say banking, I should say debt crisis, but it's like a global program to put countries or states like California that, you know, could very well, we could be our own country, to put us into major debt and to, you know, force the governments to cut back on services to pay off that debt.
Right. Actually, that's what my book, Web of Debt, was about, and I wrote a follow-up book called The Public Bank Solution, that we are led to believe, you look at your dollar bill and you look at your coins and you think that the government issued those. Everybody thinks the government issues the money and that the government must be rich and that there's this, it's the government that's messing everything up. But in fact, the government does not issue our money. It's the Federal Reserve issues the paper dollar bills, and they're not federal. They're composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district, and they're controlled by the big banks. But even the Federal Reserve notes are only a very small part of the money supply. Most of the money supply is credit issued by banks, and they do it by double-entry bookkeeping, so they actually create credit on their books equal to their deposits, less some percentage. So they're actually creating credit, and even more nefarious, they create credit in the shadow banking system, which is quite complex. But what they're doing is taking our mortgages, which they've chopped up into little pieces and made them fungible like money, and they use that as collateral in the repo market to then borrow. So what they borrow is, in effect, new money. Every time you open an account, that counts as new money when they count the money supply. All of our money comes into the system as a debt, but it's always a debt at interest. So there's never enough money in the system at any one time to pay off the debt just because it always came in with extra debt attached in the form of interest.
Right.
So the only way to get that to come to balance is you've got to give the interest back. So you've got to give the interest back to the government. You know, we the people have to, if we the people own the bank, then we get the interest back, and then it goes into the system in other ways. You know, big bankers don't spend their profits on, they don't just spend it on Social Security and, you know, paying for roads and bridges and all that. They put it in offshore tax havens where it continues to be making more money, or they make more loans, which are, again, at interest. So it's this whole exponential growth thing. So if you give it back to the government, if the government owns the bank, then the government will spend it in place of taxes. So that saves the people money in the sense that, in fact, we have it. There's a good model for that is Costa Rica. In 1949, they had a big revolution, and it was the poor people rebelled, basically, and the winner realized that if he wanted to keep the peace, he was going to have to do something for the poor people. So he nationalized many things, many industries, and put people to work. He guaranteed everybody a job. So most people were either working for the government directly for their government-owned industries, or they were working for businesses that were supported by the government. So, and then there were a couple of attempted coups, and so he just got rid of the military. I mean, this did wonderful things for the budget. Imagine if we got rid of our military. So then Costa Rica did marvelously well after that, and they nationalized the banks. And even now, they are 80% of deposits are in publicly owned banks, and the people just won't give them up because they like their publicly owned banks. They're very secure, and the profits go back to the people. So they support local industry, local business.
So the people of California would still have to do business with banks that are part of the Federal Reserve, and we would still have to transact, business or, transactions with Federal Reserve notes or debt. So, as a person, Ellen, as a writer and as a person, as a candidate, what would be your, solution to the Federal Reserve? Some people say abolish it. Some people say nationalize it. Put it under the democratic control of the communities that it serves. What is your thinking on that?
I would say nationalize it because it would be very traumatic to try to escape the entire system we've got. I mean, you could invent your own currency and call it Bitcoin or something like that.
Right.
Your own electronic currency, but you've got to get everybody to accept it. And then there's the fact that federal taxes are going to be owed in Federal Reserve notes, even if the whole state were to basically start its own currency, which they can't do. That's another thing. It's unconstitutional. So I don't think the system we have is really has potential. We just need to tweak it a bit. We need to get it back. In other words, our system has been stolen from us, right? And the dollar has been stolen from us. But if the Federal Reserve were basically made part of the Treasury, if the banking, what I think is that banking should be a public utility. It should be totally transparent, totally accountable, and we the people should get the profits. So it should be like one giant co-op, or you could say like one giant credit union, or like one giant community currency system, where we just acknowledge that all we're talking about here is credits and debits, that all money is debt. It's just like I do something for you, then you owe me. Maybe you don't have what I want, so you write me a little IOU. That's how a community currency works. You acknowledge that, like, I belong to one called Friendly Favors, so you would write me a few favors, and then I could spend those favors on somebody else. So that's basically what money is. It originates with the people, and the money supply should reflect the goods and services produced by the people, and it should, when those debts are paid off, then the money disappears. You know, it comes and goes with obligations and the extinguishment of obligations.
Well,
so you can keep track of that on a big giant computer in the sky, and that's what I think banking should be.
Right. So, perfect. We have an opportunity to elect, the people of the state of California have the opportunity to elect you as state treasurer. And I am so happy that my party, Peace and Freedom Party, has endorsed you and Laura. And, of course, I wholeheartedly support and endorse both of you. And what could the treasurer do? What would we have to have a proposition to change the state constitution to actually create a state bank?
Some people say you would. I'm a lawyer, and I've looked at that legislation that they're talking about, and it doesn't look to me like that. There is part of the constitution says that the state shall not lend its credit for private purposes. But if that means that you can't put your money in a bank or you can't form a bank, then we're already doing it because we're giving our money to J.P. Morgan, and they're lending it.
Right.
So the state's credit is already being lent. And we already have, for example, an infrastructure bank, and it lends credit. It lends the credit of the state. So it seems to me that can't be what that provision means, but if they want to be super clear, I suppose there would be some sort of argument about it, but I would argue that that can't be what it means, or if it is, we're already in violation.
Right. So, how do you think we need to set up a state bank?
Well, you could actually the Bank of California is now defunct. I used to bank at the Bank of California.
Right, I know.
They cover the name.
Those banks are defunct now.
Yeah, a lot of banks. I know. My two local banks are now U.S. Bank and J.P. Morgan Chase.
Right.
So you could just buy a bank and that's already got a charter, but since it's the state, which is so big, I mean, they could certainly get their own charter easily enough. But if you bought a bank and you were careful to make sure it didn't have too many liabilities that you were buying into, you could be set up and running in a couple of months. It's just the hard part is persuading the legislature to do it. But I think what might motivate them, I can just envision, you know, all this bail-in talk. Let's say J.P. Morgan or Bank of America got into big derivative trouble, and this time Dodd-Frank has made it clear, and the president has made it clear that this time we're not going to bail you out when that happens.
Right.
So they have been instructed from on high by the Financial Stability Board in Switzerland to, in that case, to do a bail-in, which is to convert debt to equity. Well, it turns out that the depositors are the largest class of creditors of any bank. So basically what they're going to do is turn our deposits into stock in their bankrupt bank, just as happening in Cyprus. So when that happens, people are going to be up in arms. If they do it to the state's deposits, which I think they well could, the state thinks they're secured, but their security takes a back seat to the derivatives claimants who are first in line in a bankruptcy, and they're liable to snatch all the security. So if the state lost some money, you could just see they'd be scrambling very quickly for some alternative. And in that case, it would be good to know, you know, it'd be good to have a plan ready and say, oh, look, you can do this very quickly and get out of it. I mean, they might lose a lot of money in the meantime, but, or if they see that that's about to happen, they might jump into some new plan. You know, it's amazing what governments can do when they get their mind to it. Like in the 1930s, when the conservatives were so much against going further into debt, and then all of a sudden we had World War II, and then suddenly the money appeared. It was amazing.
Right, exactly.
Where it came from, nobody knows, but they had all the money they needed to fund a major world war.
So, Ellen, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And I know that I think part of our jobs as alternative candidates is to inspire the voters and our citizens of our state. And they're the ones that should be all over the legislature here in California demanding this. And, of course, if we get our deposits expropriated for nefarious means, that would be a good motivator. But, you know, thank you for your candidacy to be able to help educate people and inspire people. I look forward to speaking with you at the Westside Peace Center in Culver City on March 22nd about these issues. But let my listeners know your website so they can find out more information and support your campaign if they wish.
Okay, and thanks, Cindy, for your activism. You set such a great example for voters and for people in general. I think it's marvelous. My website is EllenBrown.com has over 200 articles on it, on banking and finance type issues that I've written. And then my campaign website is EllenBrownForTreasurer.org with a number 4.
Great, Ellen Brown.
Oh, and then one more.
Go ahead.
PublicBankingInstitute.org.
Okay, awesome. And we'll put all those links on our newsletter and our post about this show also, and your colleague Laura Wells and my friend will also be on this program. So I think it'll be a great program. And again, Ellen Brown, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, and we will definitely talk soon.
Oh, great! Thank you, Cindy.
Well, that's Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox for today. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. I hope you were inspired to help Laura and Ellen and myself become elected here in the state of California. We can do it. We can change the world, as our comrade Hugo Chavez and the World Social Forum says. There is a better world. A better world is possible. I'd like to thank my engineer, Don DeBar, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller, my sometimes associate producer, Mikey. Mikey helps us off and on. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. We're going to close with a song that songwriter and performer Basil Harris Jr. wrote that was inspired by my vigil at Camp Casey some almost 10 years ago. So this is the Gold Star Mother song by Basil Harris Jr. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.
I'm the fallen soldier's mother. I keep vigil in the desert by your road. Bundled in my grief against the cold. They wonder why I bother to stand each day and face your passing car. On this road too far, but there is no other way. My son lies dead today, and I need to know the reason for this war. I am torn and I am lonely. I'm scared, only I won't be turned aside. I will not cower or retreat. I will not hide. You face the other way each day. You pass me on this barren lone star plain. But I will remain. There's just no other way. With the price we've had to pay, we need to know they have not died in vain. And your motorcade is making its escape before the facts can slow it down. While this gold star mother stands watch along the outskirts of your town. Holding captured ground. I am every nation's conscience. I am voices that you do not want to hear. Questions that will never disappear. In your silence, I'm the thunder that echoes down your halls of certainty. Truth set free, and I will stand firm until you turn. You finally turn your head around and look at me. And I will stand firm until you turn. You finally turn your head around and look at me.